Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tekumel.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Hall of Blue Illumination. With me today are my esteemed co-hosts, James Malaszewski.
Hello.
And Victor Raymond.
Hi there.
My name is Scott Kellogg. Today, we're going to talk about a sentence once uttered by Professor Barker, and that is, there are no NPCs on Tekumel. Victor, what do you think of that?
Well, actually, Phil was very straightforward about this. He thought it highly inexplicable that people who were in the process of playing fantasy characters who had no particular reality themselves would treat those characters as being different or better or special than the characters that Professor Barker was presenting them with. That's the people that they ran into in Jakala or in Thraya or Yancor City, they were just as real as the characters that the players imagined. And if more so, I think to Professor Barker, there was a sense that they were more real in a sense because he knew who they were. You know, player characters were themselves somebody else's creation. So...
Well, that's a callback to something we talked about in a previous episode where the player characters aren't necessarily the focus of the world. I think some other games presume that the player characters are, since they're in the lens, such as it is, that they are the most important people in the fictive environment. But with this notion of there are no NPCs on Tekumel, it would seem that the player characters are simply one of, or you know, several of millions of people milling about, living their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, this goes along with one of the aspects of Tekumel that I think people sometimes, well, I think people pay attention to, but. This is an aspect they may not always think all the way through, which is that Tekumel provides this society, these cultures, this framing for what's going on, that the player characters are in something much bigger than themselves, and that includes the people that live there, the people that they encounter, and so. I think this goes against the trend, as you were saying, of some more recent games, which kind of, you know, put player characters on some sort of special status, you know, assumed to be heroes from the start. Professor Barker would say, no, you aren't a hero. You can demonstrate your heroism. And if you're successful, then you might be a hero. But until then, you're no different than any other scuzz bucket that is walking through the foreigner's quarter of Jakala.
Scuzz bucket.
How do you say that in Solyani?
I have no idea. I should probably go find that out. I might just do that.
There must be a word in Solyani for that has, you know, the force of, you know, barbarian or, you know, just something of that sort. Not merely are you a foreigner, but you're sort of, you know, uncultured and unlettered.
Uncouth, yes.
Yeah, there must be a word like that.
There is a form of the word you, as in, you know, the you of wide traveling, the you of odd splendor. There is the you that you use with slaves and clanless people.
True, that's true.
And it is the equivalent of saying something like, you know, just sort of ordering someone around. Here, come here, you know. Hey, you, get over here. But yes, I suspect that there are descriptive terms besides that in Solyani for people like that. And And actually, I think this idea of there, you know, the other characters on Tekkumel having their own reality, you can tell that right from any of the biographies that Professor Barker has presented of different people at different times, whether it's in the source book or in other materials. You can tell that they are people that he knows, you know, that he attributes to them the same sense of personal complexity that one would attribute to, you know, someone that, you know, you knew as a friend or a colleague or a business associate or a family member, you know. And I think that's a mindset that's worth encouraging. I mean, I really do. I think that by thinking of these people as real in their own context, then that makes people's reactions more real in dealing with them and in them dealing with player characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think the thing is, too, that's important, and I know we you and I, Victor, have talked sort of about this, is that, you know, when you treat these other characters with the same kind of, I hate to use the word respect, maybe that's not quite the word I mean, but when you view them not as just, you know, oh, goodness, what's the word I'm looking for here? You know, not just as, you know, set dressing for a story in which the, you know, the player characters are the protagonists. It opens up, I think, a lot of possibilities in terms of the way that, you know, you experience Tekkumel. I mean, I can tell you with, you know, 100% certainty that many times when I have been running Tekkumel, the player characters have become interested in some NPC, you know, some character that I just came up with at that point and invested with a certain amount of individuality and sort of in life, I guess. And I had never intended that to be the case. And they go off on some tangent, which has proven to be way more interesting than anything I would have done on my own, precisely because this guard or this little kid who delivered a message to them from some member of another clan or a random official that they encountered, for whatever reason, because I'd thought a little bit about what he might be like and how he might talk or what his interests are, or why he was doing what he was, it caught their attention and it sparked things that would never, I suspect, wouldn't have happened if I had just simply tripped, oh, he's just a guy, you know. I don't want to imply that every single NPC that I've ever created or played in the course of a long campaign was fleshed out to that degree, but I do try in general when these things come up to think of something about who they are, where they came from, and why they are who they are. That's why I try to give everyone a name. It's hard to treat people as faceless when they have a name. That's a really big and important thing to me. You know, that's why I keep a list of names available so that when someone is encountered and they ask, well, who are you? I can at least say, you know, I am such and such of this lineage and this clan, or, you know, I am a foreigner from this place and my name is, so that at least it begins that process of recognizing that these are actually people. And I find it really very helpful, at least, I mean, just for even for me to enter into Tekkumel.
It's interesting to hear you. Go ahead, Scott.
I love it when the players come up with plausible connections between your sketched out NPCs that are far more amazing than anything you may have come up with in isolation.
That's been my way I run my campaign for 2.5 years.
I love it. It's, I mean, they're things that are plausible. You know, they see things from different angles. So making connections that, you know, were there all the time? Well, yes, sir, certainly they were.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And this has bearing in one other respect. I mean, I think the idea of keeping a list of names nearby specifically for the purpose of doing this is worthwhile. Though I will admit that there's something that I've occasionally seen happen, which I find to be a bit jarring. Okay. And I think it has to do with how people encounter material for Tekkumel, but I have occasionally come across referees who have given names to characters that are essentially the throne names of emperors and empresses.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Okay. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that, look, here's some names. Let's use them, right? You know, so here's Shirasu, here's Vayamasu, you know, here's Durume, here's Hetkulainen, here's and any of a number of others. You know, Gyasmu Dalisa, right? And for me, what I get out of that is, yes, they're trying to use Solyani names, but it would be sort of the equivalent of, well, this guy's name is Thomas Jefferson, and over there is Dolly Madison, and, you know, John Quincy Adams is right over there, and the merchant on the street is named Abraham Lincoln, you know.
Sounds like an irreverent comedy party.
Well, I wish it were, but I think part of the problem is that there, in terms of names, there is a, I suspect that there's a labor of reverence to do out there for someone to just simply catalog names out of different published materials and make those available as ways to, you know, put people, you know, put names together for people to use. But that having been said, I think that the idea of giving names, having them there, or having generated characters ahead of time, I realized with a bit of a shock that I have probably several hundred NPCs, though I use the term, several hundred characters that I've generated for use with Techamel, that I've literally got in a whole bunch of different formats, everything from 8.5 by 11 sheets to 3 by 5 cards to who knows what. Now I understand why Phil put everything on 3 by 5 cards. It was just easy.
So on the topic of keeping track of referee-created characters, I've gone back and forth between paper documents of various kinds and electronic formats, and I've ended up using both, where I have a couple of journals that I write in the morning for my various game ideas. I bring that to the session, but since I work on a computer all day, I also keep track of a lot of stuff in a note-taking program. But the notes are available on my phone. So, I guess what I'm getting at is, if you have that much information, especially a lot of characters that you've created, you've got to have a good way of keeping track of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3x5s thing is great. Dan Lawrence at the Purdue Fantasy Club in the 80s used everything on 4x6s, and all of the player character cards were on 4x6s. And you just walked up to the desk and got your character out of the box when it was time to play. I'm wondering, were the early Techamel sessions similarly organized? Where were the character sheets, all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. No, you had a 3x5 card. Phil would provide you with a 3x5 card, and you were expected to fill out your character to, you know, on the confines of that card, and then Phil would keep it.
So it was a blank card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were, I should note, they are color-coded.
According to religion, right? Didn't we talk about
that? That's correct. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. White cards represent worshippers of Nala or Hu'u. Let's see here. Orange cards represented characters who worshipped either Karakhan or Vimukla. Green cards. God, I'm trying to remember how this all worked again. Blue cards, I think, were either Avante or Tlemenish, and even though they were greens, I mean, I think the greens ended up being used for, I don't have to go back and look. I think the greens were for Thumis or Kasarl. I may be getting blue and green confused there. I may be blue-green colorblind. I'm not sure. And then on, I think yellow. Yeah, yellow was for Belcano or Sarku.
I almost tried to get a Shitting Guy-y joke in there with the blue-green color blindness, but couldn't quite put it together.
Mm.
I know, right? I should have just stayed home. So, how do you guys keep track of all of your NPCs? I mean, Victor, you say you have, like, bunches of things in different formats. That doesn't sound like retrieval is particularly easy.
No, it's not. And I'm thinking at this point that what I would end up doing with that, I believe at one point I was going to standardize on 4x6s, partly because I wanted a little more information than you could fit on a 3x5. But I also discovered that it without putting too fine a point on it, a 4x6 card gives you some room to do stuff, but even player characters occasionally want more space than that. So I'm thinking about it. There is also some occasional virtue to using 8.5x11, or I suppose A4, but you know, basically some full sheet record. But then that just ends up becoming massive stacks and stacks and stacks. Looks like you're conducting the Imperial Census by the time you're done.
Yeah. Well, I what I do is that I tend to write things down. I have lots of notes all over my desk. It's quite horrible. And then after a session, the NPCs, you know, again, GM, create, whatever, we'll call them NPCs.
That's what they're called.
That's what they are. We were being rhetorical earlier. There are no NPCs. But the NPCs that I think are likely to reappear, or even if they're not likely to reappear, those that now it's been established that, you know, the captain of the governor's guard is this person, or the owner of this shop in the foreigner's quarter is such and such, those that are of significance, I then write them up, give a little sort of brief description of them in electronic form. And I put that also, I have that in the community page of the Google Plus communities associated with the two campaigns that I'm currently running. So it's available for the players as well, because frankly, I mean, all of us, we forget these things, and it's easy. It's better to have those things there listed. And I usually divide them up according to like clan or location or whatever, some way in order to identify them, say, oh, okay, this guy was an administrative high priest in the temple of Xarl. Here he is. Or if it's a clan, it's a particular importance, it'll be listed in that way. But point being, so that it's accessible to everyone, including the players, because as I said earlier, sometimes the players have better ideas than I do. And they're like, hey, what about so-and-so that we met the other day? Wouldn't he be helpful in help, you know, in figuring this out? It's like, yes, he would. Why don't you go talk to this person whose name I've forgotten until I just looked at this page? You know, but that's what I do.
Well, there's an advantage to running a Hangouts or other online service game in that you can have a digital repository of information that's very easy to share between sessions or during the sessions. I mean, a face-to-face game is, there's certainly no substitute for that, but having done more online play in the last few years, I'm really starting to appreciate what it has to offer.
Well, the interesting thing is, too, on keeping a repository, though, is, I mean, so there was Professor Barker literally had, like, index card files, yes?
Oh, yes, we have them.
Because it's just a funny thing, as an aside here, just, and by no means am I putting myself, you know, comparable to Professor Barker here in this respect, but when I was in high school, I did the exact same thing with my D&D campaign that I was running. I have, and still have, I have it still, a little wooden file box filled with NPCs that I had written up of all the various people that were encountered in the course of the campaign. And it's funny to have learned later in life that Professor Barker had done something similar, because years later, when I came upon it, when I discovered it, forgotten about it, I thought it was the most absurd thing I'd ever done, and just proved just how, you know, sort of obsessive I was about things. But I guess maybe not.
I think that there is value in having both a physical copy, whether it's a character sheet or a card or whatever, and as well as having an electronic resource. I've been in the stages of starting, or I should say restarting, my my Techmel campaign. And I'm now up to 4 players, which is nice. And I found that even in some place, or especially some place like Jakala, there's more than enough people to keep you all busy. And in fact, it's also not a bad idea to keep track of who is where. You know, like I found myself beginning to build a list of, so who's the administrative high priest, who's the ritual high priest, who's the scholar high priest for each temple, who's the imperial governor, who's the chief of the market police, you know, who is, and some of these are like, you have them because they're, you know, important ranks in society, but sometimes you want to keep track of that guy, right? Who is that garrulous slave merchant who, you know, had that really handsome guy that we bought? You know, it's like, okay, let me go back and look, right? So having that electronically where you can easily reference it is probably not a bad idea at all.
Do you guys keep session notes after each session? I've been doing that for a long time.
I have not done as much of that, and I have to say it is the one aspect of gaming that I think people would do well to do more of, is just to keep better notes. It's just so much easier to come back to a game after you've kept track of what was going on. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right about that, Victor, as we know firsthand. But I don't actually do that myself, to my regret, and having come back from holiday and not having played for about a month or so, I wish I had some reminders of exactly what was going on, because I found the last sessions, for example, were it took me a little while to remember what was going on, and having some kind of a recap would have been helpful. But, you know, again, laziness.
I just use bullet points. It's pretty fast. Full sentences, just the facts, quickly jot it down. It doesn't really take much time.
I would be interested in seeing some examples of that, Scott, just because that is a discipline technique that I would actually like to try out. I'd like to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
There is another aspect of there are no NPCs on Techmel that I think is reflected in the game mechanics of Empire of the Petal Throne.
Go on.
Okay. Actually, I know this one to be true, so this is not idle speculation. This is something that Phil himself talked about several times. And that was the rules for obtaining an instant kill. Okay.
Oh, yes. That's a very good point. I have a story about that, but please go on.
Yeah, well, the idea that's in the rules, and people ran across it, and it became, actually, it was interesting. I've seen that become a D&D house rule, the idea that you roll natural 20, and you roll again, and on a 19 or a 20, it's an insta-kill. Okay. And I've seen this happen as a D&D house rule, which I'm sure people got originally from EPT. But the idea of an instant kill was based on a very simple belief, very straightforward belief that Professor Barker had, which was that no character, no matter how powerful, no matter how strong, no matter how invincible, could still be taken out with a single shot. And that he felt very strongly that it introduced a sense of risk for player characters that was not only warranted, but very much worthwhile in its own right.
The story that I have to tell is, and I had forgotten about it until just this moment, was I remember back in the 90s, in the days of the Usenet news group dedicated to Techmel, Rec Games, FRP, Techmel. This would have been, I guess, sometime around when Gardasiol had come out, sure. Which unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, coincided with my actual serious entree into the world of Tecmo fandom. And there were lots and lots of conversations, let us say, debates, discussions, arguments about Gardasiel's rules going on. And I remember Professor Barker and I had started corresponding sort of intermittently about things. And I don't remember, I must have weighed in to the discussion, and I don't recall precisely what it was I said, but out of the blue, Professor Barker emailed me to sort of talk to me about the combat system and this very point. I guess perhaps because we had had good discussions and he felt he needed to vent or something, he did it to me, and I wish I had the email still, but you know, that was 25 years ago. And he said something to very much along the lines of that he felt very, very strongly that no character should ever feel completely safe in combat, that no matter how powerful they were, no matter what sort of gear they had, no matter how weak their opponent, there was always should be an opportunity for that opponent to be able to fell them, Goliath, you know, David and Goliath style, that it could just happen, that history was full of opportunity, you know, of examples of people who thought that they were invincible, who went down and were felled by, you know, a lucky blow here and there. And he also said, and this ties in, I guess, to a great extent what we're talking about, that he also said he felt that this should be true of, you know, the great characters of the setting as well, that they, you know, that history, you know, is maybe, you know, put for is advanced by great people doing great things, but sometimes things just don't go their way. And you know, that could happen to any of these important characters. You know, Baron Auld may think that he's invincible, but who knows what history, you know, what will unfold for him, and he might go down in a way. And he said that the history of Tecumel was filled with examples of, you know, would-be conquerors and, you know, tyrants and so forth who tried to do things, made it so far, and then things turned against them, and that was that. And this was very important to him. He felt this was a very, very important thing. And he encouraged me to sort of, you know, look at the history of Tecumel, you know, as it's been described and what has he written, and see that and take that to heart. And I totally forgot about this until right now. So.
Mm-hmm. And to that, yeah. And I think that that's an aspect of how Tecumel differs from a lot of games, game settings, which presume player characters are somehow the heroes. We presume them to be heroes. And given what was once referred to, what was once referred to in Alarms and Excursions as a kind of script immunity, the idea that you know, things can't happen to you, right? Which is also, again, gets back at the idea that players, I think, sometimes get unduly attach their characters, and yet, you know, this all speaks to the, so who are these people that are being fictively created, right? Who are these characters that we give a semblance of reality to? And I think it's where there's a philosophical difference. There's a real philosophical difference here between the approach that Professor Barker took, which was to say that everyone has the same degree of reality, and some games that are being produced today that suggest that, oh, you know, guards are just mooks. You hit them once, they fall down. And it's kind of like, you know, Professor Barker, I think at least philosophically disagreed with that notion.
I'm not saying that we haven't. I know
he
did, because he told me as much. And it's just, it's an interesting thing. But I thought it also fascinating that he had commented back then that this applied equally to the MPs themselves in relation to one another. That,
oh yeah, sure.
You know, there was no guarantee that anyone was a hero or the protagonist in a grand story. That's not what history was, and that people who appear to be on top at one point or at the bottom won't necessarily stay there and achieve their goals or fail to achieve them, as the case may be. You know, their unpredictability was sort of the order of the day, and that's the way he liked it. And you know, I found that very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And that's also one of the reasons why, for example, you see in Dragon Number 4, the Dragon Number 4, there's the mention in Imperial Dispatches of the association between Princess Mayine and the priest Dutlor. Princess Mayine, as I may have recounted in a previous podcast, as I understand it, was basically, I think it was this priest Dutlor, and I'm trying to remember whose character that was, might have been Tim Cox's, who proceeded to use an eye of transformation on Princess Mayine. And this was at a relatively early stage of things. And what happened was the eye of transformation is supposed to change, you know, one's alignment from, in EPT terms, from good to evil or evil to good, and, you know, stability to change. And Princess Mayine, who up until that point had been a loyal daughter of Lady Avante, failed her saving throw. And, okay. And she is now devoted to the more hedonistic pleasures of Lady Blamilish. So, yeah.
Yes. This is Dutlor. Was he not? He was a, and I know this character for some reason. Why do I know this character? Is he mentioned somewhere? He must be.
Oh, he's mentioned in dispatches. There's the dispatches read somewhat to the effect of Princess Mayine is hanging out a lot with this guy. Go check him out. And the Imperial Order is along the lines of, you know, make sure that nothing unseemly happens. Too late.
Too late for that. Well, I know there is a reference, I think, is it in Swords and Glory, about the fact that her inexplicable change of you know, attitude from serving Avante to Dlamelish.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep, exactly.
But was it not the case that Professor Barker was not too happy about this to begin with?
he was quite. The one consequence that this had was that Professor Barker began to be much more aware of where the player characters were and what they were doing, and thought twice about having situations where things might happen. Okay. Which is not to say that he barred player characters from, you know, having any effect on the world. I think he just, I think you're talking about what he had talked with you about, he had emailed you about.
Yes.
This was a case of like, okay, if I'm going to be true to my principles, this is what's going to happen. I don't have to
right.
like it.
He did allow it to happen. That's right.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to think about, because I can't speak for anyone else, but you know, when you read about the great goings on in Solyanu or wherever, I tend to think of the Imperial princes and others, you know, important named characters, in a way that suggests that, you know, they have their own trajectories that go along, you know, that Professor Barker had some plans for them. And maybe he did, I guess, but it doesn't mean that those plans can't be disrupted, or that there's necessarily a guarantee that they will achieve whatever it is that they're attempting to achieve. Because after all, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I mean, I remember reading for the first time the descriptions, all the various princes that were going to vie for the throne one day, and having my own sense of, oh, well, clearly, you know, Selene is guaranteed, he's going to become the emperor. It's quite clear that's how things are going to go. Well, we all know that didn't happen.
Did you really feel that way?
I did feel that way, yes.
Wow.
See him,
I always
clear
thought he was kind of a bit of a thickie.
He is a bit of a thickie, but I still just sort of figured he seemed to have all the right, you know, backers and supporters, and, you know, that's just the way it was going to go. Now, obviously, I was wrong. But then, of course, you know, you could have different things happen in your own TechML, as you wish. But that seemed to be where things were going. But events, you know, took care of that. And I think that's sort of that's the appeal of TechML to me. Well, it's one of the many, many appeals of TechML. It's just that it's quite an unpredictable sort of a place. And they follow on. It's not as if you can come up with in advance an idea of how things are going to go. You know, there's no real sense that's like, okay, well, many of the events of TechML feel they're not out of left field, but they aren't, oh, that's not what I imagined would happen.
Well, that's why a person who runs a TechML game is called a referee.
Yes, well, true.
As opposed to, you know, many newer games that have more scripted storylines.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can say that, you know, in running these two TechML campaigns that I'm doing right now, I have ideas of where I'd like things to go, and I sort of get the ball rolling. And provided that ball, or balls as the case may be, are not interfered with by what the characters do, or some spin-off of what the characters have done, they just go about that sort of a logic. But, you know, I'm very much in favor of a kind of very hands-on kind of world. I like people to sort of, the players to take their characters and use them as bulls in china shops and upset things a lot. That's much more interesting to me.
Well, the Friday group must make you really happy.
You do. You absolutely do. That group is terrific. And I don't mean to slight my other group who also have done things that I did not anticipate. But the Friday group is really, truly satisfying for me because you've gone, well, I could go on at great length about why I love that group, but you frequently make decisions that I do not anticipate and go off in directions that I would not have imagined you would. And not only, I mean, it's frustrating sometimes at the time to sort of stay nimble enough to keep ahead of it, but I'm winding up exploring parts of TechML that I otherwise wouldn't have and thinking about things that I wouldn't previously. And that's fun. That's
frustrating,
great.
Frustrating or exciting?
Well,
fine line.
It's a fine line. No, I guess it's not frustrating. I guess the only sense in which it's frustrating is that I do like to anticipate things as much as possible. And I can't. It's impossible. There's no way you can do that. So, you know, that's just my own desire for control that you frustrate. So frustrate in that sense.
Excellent.
My desire to be on top of things, but no, I love it. It's terrific.
I will say one more thing about this that I think helps with understanding this better, and that is that Professor Barker also made a point. What Phil would do is that everyone had something of interest. I mean, he might talk about them as being, you know, lowly wretches of whatever sort. That's one thing. But basically, he eschewed the sort of language that occasionally gets used of, well, he's just a guard, you know, any sort of description that essentially shut down the uniqueness that he role played with the sense that if you're interacting with someone, then that someone was there just as much as your character was.
Seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, to me as well.
Do you guys ever have NPCs turn into PCs?
Yes, actually, that has happened in my other TechML game, simply due to the fact that the characters were far away from home, and some of the originals died. So they picked up NPCs. There's a character, for example, who was a low lineage member of the clan who was originally sent along with them into the wilderness as a guide and a scout because he had familiarity with the the Plane of Towers, and he was out there leading them along so they wouldn't get into too much trouble, and one of the other PCs died, and so he became a character. So yes, that has happened.
It just works great, especially if it happens in the, like, somebody dies in the middle of a session, if there's an NPC that's got a name and a description and maybe an occupation, but really it doesn't have too much backstory. You can just flip that to the player, and then the player can fill in the stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I like that, too, from another perspective, in that it does for players, much like what happens with me as a referee, and that sometimes it means a player will wind up being given a character that they have to play that wouldn't necessarily be what they would have chosen if they're like, okay, for next session, you need to create a new character. But they pick up this role and invest, you know, their own take on it. And it, again, I found it works. It can work exceptionally well. Lets people sort of go outside their natural inclinations. And, you know, I think we all have our tendencies as we run things or play characters that, you know, favorites, sort of tropes we fall back on and so forth. But when you're given this NPC and it's like, oh, that's totally unlike what I would have done, it could be really quite fascinating. And I've seen it used to good effect. It's quite good.
Well, I intend to play a non-human next time I have the opportunity to generate a new character.
I think you have mentioned that on a couple of occasions, which is why it's quite convenient that we have Shen in the campaign now.
That's right. Playing a Shen would be very out of type for me. I always play the wizard kind of thing. The spellcaster guy. So being a warrior will be...
Well, I'm hoping Hune does not die anytime soon, but should such a unfortunate event happen, as might occur to a priest of Shru'u, then, you know, might he go to join his master?
He has an unhealthy interest in demonology.
He does.
So a referee-controlled character can roll a 20 followed by a 19 or 20, and it's curtains!
He could. Well, in fact, again, it's funny you should say that, because that is precisely how the scout character got to be a PC. That very thing happened. Where it was sort of, and I roll back then, I was capable of rolling the dice out in the open, and they saw it, and it was a 20 followed by another 20, and the character just died. And I felt so sad because this character had been there since the beginning. I liked the character a great deal. He was fun. He was different. But that's what happened. And the player, you know, he took it in good spirit, and he happily picked up the other character to play. But that's exactly what occurred.
Let the dice fall where they may. That is definitely a first-generation role-playing game concept.
Professor Barker summed it up very neatly in his own words for that. The dice never lie.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.